Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
why do states use third parties to intervene in other nations' wars and conflicts? And first,
what is going on with the Supreme Court? How damaging has its recent terms been for everyday people? And what kind of reforms are needed to check the power of a rogue court? With us are two constitutional experts. Erwin Chemerinsky is the Dean and Jesse Chopper, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. His many publications include the most recent, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, and The Religious Clauses, The Case for Separating Church and State. Also joining us is Andrew Koppelman. He is the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. He's the author of The Increasingly Dangerous Variants of the Most Favored Nation Theory of Religious Liberty and The Supreme Court and the New Religious Aristocracy. So welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle. It's a great pleasure to be hosting you. I thought I should start by characterizing the Supreme Court's most recent terms. Of course, we heard a lot about overturning Roe versus Wade and a little bit about what may looks to me essentially as undoing presidential duties that are in Article 2. But I thought we should start with kind of a more general idea of what has come out in these last few terms. And what does this all mean? Where is it taking us? What is the big picture here? Erwin Chemerinsky, what do you see as what the Supreme Court is doing?
25 years ago, I wrote the first edition of a constitutional law casebook. This year, the seventh edition was published. I've never done a new edition that was so different from the prior edition or all of the prior editions than this one. Constitutional law has changed so much in the last 3 years. The courts, as you mentioned, overruled Roe versus Wade. The courts dramatically expanded gun rights. The courts imposed major new limits on administrative agencies. The Supreme Court's overruled 45 years of precedent that allowed college universities to engage in affirmative action. The Supreme Court, for the first time, has said that a business has a First Amendment right to engage in discrimination, violation of anti-discrimination laws. The Supreme Court, for the first time in history, has given the president broad absolute immunity from criminal prosecutions for anything done in carrying out the powers of the office. All of what I mentioned was 6-3, at least in result, and virtually all of them were 6-3 decisions. It's a reflection that these are the first three terms we've had six conservative justices, and we've seen what the effect of that is.
So is this just a different view of law, or is this politics?
Well, I'm not sure I would accept the distinction between two, and I'm not sure what you mean by those words. What I would say is that to understand this version of the Roberts Court, you have to see it as very much animated by the conservative Republican ideology. And so I don't think it's about judicial methodology, certainly not about judicial restraint, but it is very much a group of justices who are following the current conservative ideology.
Andrew Koppelman, do you agree with Dean Chemerinsky's view?
I think that I would just add a couple of things. I mean, there is an ideology here. What's remarkable is the tendency of this court in case after case to simultaneously recite its virtue and judicial restraint and describe what it is doing in neutral terms. We're just relying on abstract principles that are universally valid. And it's most remarkably, in each case, the result that it reaches coincides precisely with the agenda of the Republican Party, and in many cases overrides decisions that the American people have stood behind for decades. Erwin briefly mentioned administrative law. So administrative agencies have been delegated broad power by Congress. The Environmental Protection Agency gets to do You really exercise a lot of discretion to make the air cleaner, the water drinkable. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has given a broad instruction: make sure that people don't die while they're at the workplace. And OSHA gets to figure that out. And the Supreme Court has imposed restraints on this. There's a variety of them, but the one that I guess is most revealing is what they call the Major Questions Doctrine. Where if something is really major, the court is going to presume that Congress did not mean to delegate it. And one of the factors that the court cites in order to determine whether something is a major question is whether it is producing a lot of controversy now. So, for example, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has, as part of its job, making sure that you don't inhale something at work that is going to kill you. And most emphatically, not inhale something at work that's going to endanger your family. But when the Biden administration tried to impose mask requirements in the workplace, the court said, well, that it goes too far. Congress couldn't have intended that. And the way that we know that is that masks have become really controversial now. Lots of people are fighting about this now. So it's not about the intention of the Congress when it passed the statute. It's about what's happening now. So what the court has, in essence, done is delegated to Fox News the power to amend the United States Code. And Erwin, I hope that you're going to say this in the next edition of your casebook because, law students they don't, whatever their politics are, they want to know what the law is and they want to know what the sources of law is just so they can state what the law is. So I think that if Fox News is a source of US constitutional law and US statutory law, and if Fox News is a branch of government that gets to amend the US code, students should be told that. I'm
Erwin?
just reporting the news here.
Erwin Chemerinsky, what do you think about that?
I agree with everything that Andrew just said. And I think it's so important to keep in mind that this isn't a court that's had any respect for precedent and stare decisis. He mentions the case where the Supreme Court overruled so-called Chevron deference, a 40-year-old decision that said that courts should defer to the expertise of agencies so long as the agency is acting reasonably. It's always been thought that when the Supreme Court is interpreting a statute, if Congress doesn't like what the Supreme Court said, Congress could change the statute. Congress could have amended the Administrative Procedure Act any time in the last 4 decades. We've talked about overruling Roe versus Wade. We haven't talked about the Supreme Court just a couple of years ago overruling another 40-year-old precedent that established passed when the government permitted establishing religion. The Supreme Court replaced it by saying we should look to what the founders thought. I don't know what the founders of the Constitution thought about a public high school football coach praying on the field after games.
Well, it sounds like you both have answered the question about whether this is political, if in fact Andrew Koppelman is correct about where they're getting the direction. And it's interesting, too, in a time today, if they're looking to current controversy, given the disinformation and misinformation, controversy can be created almost at any time. Andrew Koppelman, is this something that the court should even be thinking about?
I was being somewhat facetious, but because the court isn't willing to admit it, although there are sentences in the US reports that can't be read any other way. When the court decides what counts as a major question, it cites current controversy, and it's hard to imagine what that could mean other than Fox News being a source of law. And I think here, this is one of many cases where the court has been so eager to trash existing law. And the conservatives evidently have created an echo chamber among themselves that the quality of the work product has plunged. This, I would have thought, obvious objection. Wait a second, Fox News can't be a source of law. I think if you asked any of the judges, is Fox News a source of law, they would say no. But nonetheless, they allowed this opinion to be the opinion of the court without objection. And just time after time, they write opinions like this where you look at them and you think, where were their editing skills?
Well, it's interesting because this, Erwin, you mentioned the thing about the founders. I don't know what the founders were thinking about a coach praying on the football field. But we do know what the founders were thinking about some things because they put them into the Constitution. And that is, for example, Article 2, when faithfully executing the laws of the nation, taking care to faithfully execute the laws of the nation, being the primary duty of a president. How do we reconcile that if that is the primary duty of a president to faithfully execute the laws of the nation? That then he can break those very laws. How do we reconcile that, Erwin?
I'm not an originalist, but if there's any place where framers' intent is clear, it's that the framers were rejecting royal prerogatives. They wanted to make sure that no one, not even a president or a former president, is above the law. What's so stunning is, up until now, it had never been dreamed of that a president could have absolute immunity. Think about when Richard Nixon resigned from office and Gerald Ford issued the pardon. No one at that time said, a pardon is unnecessary because Nixon did this exercising powers of the president. He has absolute immunity. Not even Nixon was arguing that he had such absolute immunity. I think that Trump versus the United States is one of the Supreme Court decisions that will belong in its hall of shame. And we can identify cases in history where, in hindsight, we realize the court was egregiously wrong. What Chief Justice John Roberts said was, that so long as the president is exercising an official power granted by the Constitution or statute, the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution. The court said explicitly, the motives of the president just don't matter. So, to take Justice Sotomayor's examples, for president, using his power as commander in chief, calls on the Navy SEALs to assassinate a political rival, it'd be absolute immunity. A president using his powers to oversee, the Justice Department orders it to engage in a prosecution for political retribution, absolute immunity. The president, using his powers under the Constitution to grant pardons or make appointments, takes bribes, absolute immunity. It flies in the face of the text of the Constitution,
That's right.
the intent of the Constitution.
So isn't
So
this actually, in fact, almost overturning a portion of the Constitution? And isn't the Supreme Court's charge to uphold the Constitution? I mean, how do we reconcile this?
Well, the bit in the Constitution that it most squarely contradicts is the impeachment clause, which says that the president squarely says the president can be prosecuted for the exact same conduct for which he's impeached. And generally, we don't impeach presidents for non-official conduct. This actually was argued during the Clinton impeachment. But the core concern is that the president is going to abuse his power. That is the primary function of impeachment. I'll say this about originalism. Originalism is the view that original meaning counts and nothing else does, which is a crazy way of reading the Constitution. But original meaning, founders' intention, is a source of law. It is relevant. It is one of many relevant inputs into constitutional interpretation. And so all of the evidence that we have, some of which was cited in the dissent in the Trump case, that the framers would have been absolutely horrified by this decision to make the president a king, I think is probative.
If you were to take this to its extreme, this idea of originalism, would the Supreme Court even have the power to make such decisions, given that it really got them from Marbury versus Madison and not the Constitution?
We'll never know the answer to that question. Article 3 of the Constitution doesn't specifically give the court the power of judicial review. Is that because, as some said, it was just assumed that it would exist? Was it because it was assumed it wouldn't exist? We'll never know the answer to that. But it is clear that if the court were to truly be originalist, it would lead to results that none of us would accept. Brown versus Board of Education can't be justified from an originalist perspective. The same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment voted to segregate District Columbia public schools. There's no evidence that Congress meant to outlaw segregation. If we were to follow the framers' intent, Loving versus Virginia, which said that states can't prohibit interracial marriage, was wrongly decided. Almost all states had laws that prohibited interracial marriage. California had one until 1948. In 1967, when Loving was decided, 16 states had such laws. If, of course, we were to be originalists, Obergefell versus Hodges. The case that said states can't prohibit same-sex marriage would be wrong-sided. In fact, Justice Scalia said on a number of occasions that equal protection doesn't safeguard women from discrimination or apply at all to sex discrimination because the framers just meant it to be about race discrimination. If we really wanted to be originalists, the government could pass a law prohibiting blasphemy or prohibiting false criticism of the government because those laws existed at the time the Constitution was written. Of course, no one would want any of those things.
I will say that originalists are an extremely varied tribe, that saying originalists think X is almost as confused as if you were to say, well, pick any other group, think X. And there are originalists who have busily worked to try to show that originalism is consistent with all of the decisions that Erwin just cited. But that calls attention to the other problem with originalism, which is that it is less determinate than it claims to be. So the court just decided the Rahimi case about the question whether you could disarm domestic abusers, and there was a deep split among the originalists as to how you read the original sources in order to decide whether this is or is not permitted by originalism. And there was a very strange, fascinating concurring opinion by Justice Kavanaugh. They almost admitting that originalism is mush, but claiming that if you had any other approach, let's say an approach that was in any way sensitive to contemporary needs, that would lead to the judiciary imposing its views on the country. And so Kavanaugh was in this strange position where he simultaneously denounced the judiciary imposing its views on the country, admitting that originalism is indeterminate, and striking down a statute that had been passed by Congress. I know, striking down a statute passed by Congress looks to me like imposing your views on the country, particularly when you admit that your source of law is indeterminate and can be read more than one way.
You've actually argued in some of your opinion pieces about tradition too, also being used in all kinds of ways, and that
That's,
itself is very mushy.
I guess we haven't yet talked about abortion. In the Dobbs opinion, Justice Alito says the test now for unenumerated protected rights is, are those rights deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions? And he cites lots of state laws that existed and were on the books when the 14th Amendment was passed. But this phrase, deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions, comes from an earlier case, Moore versus East Cleveland, where Justice Powell coined the phrase as a reason for saying that a state couldn't prevent, through its zoning laws, a grandmother from living with her grandchildren. Because that you couldn't just zone for a nuclear family. And he said there's been a long tradition of people assuming that they had the right to do this and doing this. So what he looked at was not the statutes on the books. He actually didn't cite any laws that said that grandparents could do this. He looked at what Americans actually did. Well, if you look at what Americans have actually done with respect to abortion, for almost all of American history, women have been able to terminate their pregnancies, have felt entitled to terminate their pregnancies. There was a brief burst of lawmaking in the mid-19th century that passed the laws that Justice Alito cites. They fairly quickly went into disuse and were only revived really after World War II, at the same time that the government was imposing conformity in a broad range of ways through McCarthyism, through the suppression of gay people. And what they managed to produce for the first time was this massive public health emergency where there were toxic abortion laws in every hospital in the country. So Alito didn't really correctly apply even his own tradition-based test. There is a tradition in the United States of women assuming that they could control their own bodies.
Chemerinsky, let's turn to the homelessness ruling. You had an essay arguing that we should resist this ruling. How can we resist Supreme Court rulings like this? How can it be done?
When the Supreme Court says there's not a constitutional right, not a constitutional violation, then it's still possible for states to find a constitutional right under their state constitutions, for legislatures to protect rights through law. And I think it's essential that this happen here. The case you're talking about is City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. It involves a city in southern Oregon. Its unhoused population is greater than its number of shelter beds. It adopted a series of five ordinances that ultimately made it a crime to sleep in public, even makes it a crime for someone to have a blanket or cardboard or pillow for sleeping in public. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, relying on a prior precedent, said, "This is cruel and unusual punishment. Everyone has to sleep. To make it a crime to sleep in public where the person has nowhere else to go is unconstitutional." The Supreme Court, 6-3, reversed the Ninth Circuit. Justice Gorsuch wrote for the court. He said, which is really a change in the law, that cruel and unusual punishment only applies to the type of punishment or the length of punishment, not what can be punished. And he said the issue of homelessness is left to the political process. Justice Sotomayor wrote an emphatic dissent, and I think the most famous line from it will be, she said, "What the majority is saying to unhoused is stay awake or be arrested." Now, nothing in this opinion requires that cities or the state use their criminal law against the unhoused. And one of the reasons I wrote was to say that I hope that cities and the state will be much more humane than the Supreme Court's majority was in its decision. I worry, though, that there can be a real race here to the bottom, the lowest common denominator, because some cities already are aggressively using their criminal law against the unhoused. California Governor Gavin Newsom is encouraging them to do so. On the other hand, some cities are resisting this. A week ago, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors rejected applying criminal law to the unhoused. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has rejected using the criminal law to the unhoused. But the danger then is the cities that don't use the criminal law can be places where the unhoused pushed, even dumped. There was an article on the front page of the Los Angeles Times a few weeks ago, but Burbank police rounding up unhoused individuals and literally dumping them in front of the house of the president of the Los Angeles City Council. So I think the solution, I speak here of California, needs to be the California Supreme Court finding a state constitutional right or the California legislature adopting a law. I think this is a place where just leaving it to local governments really can lead to undesirable pressures on even the most humane cities.
Are there other areas that you think we need to be resisting?
Well, take abortion that we've focused on. The Supreme Court finding no constitutional right there means it's left to the political process. And it's so important then that we, on a state-by-state basis, do everything we can to protect reproductive choice. And so far in the political process, there have been successes, even in conservative states like Kansas. But that's a place where I think it's really important to push back through the political process.
Andrew Koppelman, let's bring you in here too. Let's talk about resistance, because President Biden has introduced some ideas to reform the Supreme Court. What do you
That's
make of
right.
these?
Well, so what he's proposed three things. One is a constitutional amendment, essentially overruling the Trump decision and saying the president is not a king, the president is not above the law, the president is not authorized by the Constitution to commit crimes. So that's the first of his proposals. And those who I'm sure will vote against it, I'm eager to hear their explanation, given that one of the things that remarkable things about the Trump decision is that it actually did manage to unite left and right, at least among the scholars, in a way that is unusual. Conservatives are afraid of overweening government power, and they took a look at this and they thought, these are our judges who are creating a king. Wait. So that's one of the proposals. Another is an enforceable code of conduct for Supreme Court justices. We've seen multiple revelations of Supreme Court justices accepting expensive gifts from expensive trips from donors who clearly have strong political preferences about how the court will rule. And those justices know that if, as has sometimes happened, they adopt a different political view and start coming out in a different political direction, that the spigot is likely to be turned off. So this is, I will say, given that the ordinary code of conduct, the one that they purportedly apply to themselves, is a situation where the judge's impartiality reasonably can be questioned. These judges, and I guess Alito and Thomas are the worst here, have repeatedly brought about a state of affairs where their impartiality can reasonably be questioned. And they've done this at the same time as Biden's proposals are being resisted by people who want to assert the independence and autonomy of the court. Independence and autonomy have to be earned. You've got to earn the right people to trust you. And their behavior in this regard seems to be astounding. And then the most potent, I think, of the and immediately relevant of Biden's proposals is to have 18-year term limits for Supreme Court justices. And this is an idea that has been around for some decades now. And the basic idea is that every justice would have an 18-year term. Each president would get two appointments. So that way, you wouldn't get the strange pattern of punctuated retirements, whereby Jimmy Carter got no Supreme Court appointments and Donald Trump got three just because of the accident of when people retired and when people died.
And because of McConnell, don't forget McConnell.
No, there is that. But there is no question. Well, McConnell would say if he were here, look, the Constitution gave me the power to do this, and I exercised the power that was given to me by the Constitution. Certainly, he had the power to sit on a nomination, and he had the power to ram a nomination through before the election, and the Constitution gave him that power. The question here is whether the Constitution can be improved in this regard. There is some controversy about whether term limits could be imposed by statute or whether it requires a constitutional amendment. My own view is that it can be done by statute. The judges are guaranteed lifetime appointments, but nowhere in the Constitution does it say that they have to spend their entire lives on the Supreme Court. And so I think that a statute would be constitutional, and also the constitutionality of the statute would have to be a political question not reviewable by the Supreme Court, since it is one of the few checks on their own power. And in an earlier case, the court said it would be inappropriate for us to sit in review on the few checks that exist on our own
That would
power.
assume that they would recuse themselves from something that would be inappropriate, of course.
We actually disagree. We agree to anything else. I think it would take a constitutional amendment for term limits. I strongly believe in 18-year term limits. I've argued for it for a long time. I agree with everything you say in terms of the manipulation of the process and the accidents of history. I also think it's simply that life expectancy is thankfully a lot longer now than it was in 1787. From 1787 until 1970, the average tenure of a Supreme Court justice was remarkably constant, 15 years. Since 1970, for those who have left the bench, the average tenure is 27 years. Clarence Thomas was 43 when he was confirmed in 1991. If he stays until he's 90, that's 47 years on the court. It's too much power in one person's hands for too long a period of time. But Article 3, Section 1 has always been understood as when someone is confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, they have that job until they retire, or they're impeached and removed, or they die. I don't think there's still a Supreme Court justice. We say, oh, you have the title and the salary, but you don't participate as a Supreme Court justice. I don't think we could say to a tenured professor, well, you'll keep your title and your salary, but you can't teach, you can't vote on appointments, you can't participate in the school. I think that's tantamount to revocation of tenure.
Well, if this is a gloss on Article 3 that is plausible, I'll just say that this is a gloss on Article 3. Article 3 doesn't speak to the question, the fact that something has been assumed for a long time with respect to a power that Congress has never intended to exercise, I think is not conclusive to the question.
Erwin Chemerinsky, you had written a piece that kind of argued against these reforms and said, really, the way to reform this is by voting for a new president or a president who would not, continue this pattern. What makes you maintain that position over the attempted reforms?
To be clear, I support all of the reforms that President Biden proposed. But I think two of the three take a constitutional amendment, and they're not going to happen in the foreseeable future. The other, in terms of an enforceable code of ethics, could be done by statute, but it's also not going to happen in the foreseeable future. Last year, when the Senate Judiciary Committee voted in favor of an enforceable ethics code, the vote was 12 to 11, flew exactly along partisan lines. A Republican House at this moment, given the context of the ethical issues, isn't going to vote for ethics reform. So the point that I made in this piece in the New York Times was that it's not worth at this moment focusing on these reforms. What we should be focusing on is how important the presidential election is going to be for the composition of the United States Supreme Court. And I think it's interesting how quickly attention to the Biden proposals faded. They got a flurry of attention, but nobody's talking about them any longer. Unfortunately, also not talking about what I think should be one of the most important issues in the election, who Donald Trump or who Kamala Harris be likely to put on the court, and what it's going to mean for all of our rights for a long time to come.
Yeah, or for sure they get somebody to appoint because there is always that. And the issue is, of course, the president can't undo the cases, right? So we get a new president, they may or may not get appointments. And obviously, they can't undo the damage that is being done by some of these decisions. So I guess the other avenue, which is also unlikely to go anywhere, is Alexandria Cortez's proposal and invocation of impeaching. We've only had one impeachment of a Supreme Court justice in the history of the United States, and he survived and remained on the court. Is this just a waste of time?
It takes more votes to impeach than it does to enact a statute. If you have the votes to impeach, you must have the votes to enact a statute. I will say, the reason why I think that these proposals from Biden are a very big deal is because when you don't have the votes, it matters quite a lot what the position of a political party is, because the politics and the votes can change very quickly. One of the remarkable things of the last 2 weeks is that Donald Trump has been so thoroughly flummoxed by the replacement of Biden Harris that he has been running his campaign in such an incompetent fashion that we are now looking at what we really weren't looking at a serious possibility before, the possibility that the Democrats will have the presidency and both houses of Congress. Mr. Trump is being extremely helpful to the Democrats in this regard. And so one of the lessons that we've had from the last couple of Democratic administrations is that when the Democrats get into office, it is enormously important that they know the day they walk in the door what it is that they want to do, that they not spend a lot of time figuring it out. So all of the discussions that happen when we're out of power, you don't say, oh, that's not going to pass. You have to think about the best case scenario. And here, I say the other thing that has happened in the last couple of years is that these proposals, all of them, are responses to the excesses of the Supreme Court. So these proposals, part of it is that Biden generated them, but these are proposals that Biden would not have endorsed and did not endorse a couple of years ago. He pushed to put it off on a commission. He let the commission think about it. He let them write a report that sank out of sight. He didn't propose anything. But the Supreme Court has been so egregious in the last couple of years that the Supreme Court itself has built up a consensus in favor of checking its power. Now, to the extent that people focus on the excesses of the Supreme Court, that I think is likely to be, at least at the margin, electorally helpful to the Democrats, because at least some of the Republicans who worried about judicial oligarchy really meant it and really are bothered by this. And so the fact that one is able to point to that, I think, is helpful. I would like to see a term limits statute enacted. I agree with Erwin that a constitutional amendment isn't happening anytime soon. I'd like to enact the statute and see what happens. My own view is that it is constitutional. We will see whether the Supreme Court has the chutzpah to say, well, you know, it's not only the president who is a king with absolute power, us too.
Well, we are just about out of time, but Erwin Chemerinsky, if you have a final word, we'll take it.
I think we're at the beginning of the Roberts Court's very conservative revolution with regard to constitutional law. If you look at the age of the justices, Clarence Thomas is 76, Samuel Alito is 74, John Roberts is 69, and Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett are all still in their 50s. It's possible to imagine this group of justices being together for another 10 years, and I think we're going to continue to see kinds of radical changes in the law, all pushing it very much to the right.
Well, thank you both so very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Andrew Koppelman and Erwin Chemerinsky. Always a pleasure to host you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Always fun. Thank you.
That was Erwin Chemerinsky and Andrew Koppelman. Chemerinsky is the Dean and Jesse H. Chopper Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And Andrew Koppelman is the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University.
Why do states use third parties to intervene in other nations' wars and conflicts? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why do states use third parties to intervene in other nations' wars and conflicts? Host Doug Becker interviews Andrew Mumford on the legality, efficacy, and implications of waging proxy warfare.
Conflicts are increasingly complex, and often external nations choose to intervene. But this intervention is often indirect in the form of proxy actors. On today's show, I discuss the phenomena of proxy warfare with Andrew Mumford. He's the deputy head of the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Nottingham and the author of Proxy Warfare. Professor Mumford, first, what do we mean by proxy warfare?
I think it's important that we start to understand proxy warfare in a modern context, one that tries to evolve proxy wars away from its traditional connotations as a Cold War era style of conflict, where essentially I think a third party intervenes in a pre-existing war, be it a civil war, a conventional war, an insurgency type conflict, and intervenes deliberately to try and manipulate the outcome of that conflict by arming or funding a particular party. And this is something that we've seen throughout history. And it's this sort of arms, what I call arm's length interference in a pre-existing conflict, which really can manipulate and change the outcome in often quite dangerous ways of pre-existing wars.
It seems to me one of the core questions here now becomes one of agency or who's driving the conflict, because there seems to be two very specific types of conflicts. The first, where local actors are fighting for political control, and it might be ideological or it might be driven by some sort of political crisis, but the external actor decides they want to choose which one of these two they would like to win. So they're enabling potentially militarized actors to fight in a war that they want in the first place, versus the notion that external actors are intervening and actually causing the war. Which is more common, and is that a fair distinction?
We've seen across the centuries that proxy wars have been visible. We've seen both kinds that you've just identified there. I think the more prevalent one is the pre-existing conflict, but one where we've seen, and this is why I've already mentioned the Cold War, because superpower politics has been integral to the way in which the amplification, the proliferation of indirect interference came about. in the second half of the 20th century, because the way in which interest really got manifest in the way in which the US and the USSR went about trying to maximize their way in which their preferred partners across what we would then call the Third World manifested. I think it's actually quite important to understand the way in which that those local actors, be it communist insurgents in Angola, or be it anti-communists in Vietnam, right? This is exactly the seeds that were grown for often what came to be bigger conflicts. You take Vietnam. It's often forgotten that the Vietnam War really began essentially as Dwight Eisenhower and then John F. Kennedy's proxy war, whereby they sent military advisors in, first in their dozens, then in their hundreds, then in their thousands, to try and ensure that the outcome of the Vietnamese civil conflict was manipulated towards the end game that they wanted. And these things then often grow out of control, and I'm sure we'll come on later on to talk a little bit about escalation and blowback, because this is one of the key problems when proxy wars rely on an agent and benefactor relationship. Often the benefactor, who will be throwing large amounts of money, large numbers of weapons at a partner on the ground, they can't often then dictate what gets done with that once the money, once the weapons have been delivered. So this is one of the ways in which proxy wars are actually really quite dangerous things once you let the genie out of the bottle.
You've highlighted one of those huge concerns, is that if you've got a benefactor and the benefactor is providing money or weapons to an actor, how much control does that really give them? And sort of connected to that, how much is the benefactor responsible for the actions of the proxy?
Legally, not particularly responsible whatsoever. This is why this is all boils down to a willingness on behalf of the benefactor on a case-by-case basis of how willing they are to own the problem. And this is why, actually, we are seeing a significant amount of negative consequence emerge from the proxy wars of the Cold War era. And I always return to the case of the American proxy war in Afghanistan mm-hmm. in the 1980s, mm-hmm. when you think about the way in which President Carter and then President Reagan really ramped up the external support for the Afghan Mujahideen, who at the time were, the logic went that they were the perfect sort of conservative anti-communist bulwark against Soviet expansionism in that part of Asia. And you're channeling huge amounts of money, huge amounts of sophisticated cutting-edge surface-to-air missile weaponry. And the moment the Soviets left, they walked away. And hastily, President George H.W. Bush had to initiate a buyback program because the Americans realized that the weaponry was getting out of control, and it was actually being used by jihadist organizations much further afield than Afghanistan. So the responsibility actually is a sort of a second order effect, because proxy wars rely on a very short term strategic imperative of wanting to get something done quickly and almost long term consequence be damned. And this is why they are very problematic. They have a very, very contested legacy. Yet policymakers still to this day find it very difficult to resist the allure of an immediate potential interference and outcome change in their favor. And that's something that's hugely problematic and always has been.
And I know one of the potential motivations for the use of proxy warfare is this notion of plausible deniability, that when the United States was supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, in particular in the early stages of that intervention, they went to great lengths to try to hide the American fingerprints on those weapons. And, mm-hmm. and so how important is the political, if not legal, plausible deniability that if these weapons are used either for actions that we would describe as war crimes or, you know, questionable use of the weapons tactically, or, like in the case of Afghanistan, by actors whose ideology is problematic.
The plausible deniability issue is intrinsically linked to perceptions of risk. And I think this is exactly why proxy war has appealed to so many nations over so many centuries, because it's a hard political calculation to decide when and how to intervene, whether you are willing to take the political risk to expend blood and treasure in using your own military forces to put boots on the ground in a foreign country to undertake an outright intervention in a pre-existing conflict, whether you are by yourself or whether you're in a much bigger formal alliance. When that perception of risk is acute, when you want to intervene, but the possibility of escalation, the international outcry that could result from you openly interfering is met with a reluctance or at least an acknowledgement that your national interest would be furthered by an intervention, but it would be harmed if it was done overtly, then this is where proxy wars have historically filled that gap, that you reduce your risk because you're not sending your own troops, but you can still get the outcome you want. And this is why Dwight Eisenhower famously called such types of indirect intervention, he called them the cheapest insurance in the world. Mm-hmm. Because if you needed it to be paid off, it could do that. And it would cost you, all it would cost you would be the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars in funding, and the same again in weapons. But not a single American casualty would be taken, and you could insulate your administration from international outcry because it wasn't you doing the direct interfering. And this is part of the allure, but it's also part of the danger. And that really is the compelling problem at the heart of this particular type of conflict.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing proxy warfare with Andrew Mumford. Now, I know historically, in particular by the 1980s, the U.S. use of proxy warfare, and I'm thinking specifically in the war in Nicaragua, did create quite a bit of political blowback, both in the U.S. and internationally. The accusations that the U.S. was much more directly involved in the attacks from the Contras in Nicaragua, a famous case brought against the U.S. at the International Court of Justice. Is that a sea change, or was that just sort of idiosyncratic to that specific case where the political blowback was seemingly greater than it was in, say, previous conflicts?
I think it was idiosyncratic. I think what we started to see by that point was a greater international set of consequences. And I think in part that is due to the rise of greater media scrutiny, greater media presence in war zones, whereby you simply couldn't hide involvement anymore. And this in part is because the notion of plausible deniability works much better in theory than it does in practice. Mm-hmm. Because when the weapons that you have provided are identifiable through serial numbers or manufacturing traits, of course it will be traced back to you. So countries have to get smarter and smarter at buying indirectly, using third parties themselves in order to provide weapons and funding. So it became more difficult to keep your hands clean. And this is why the 1980s, I think, is a really important juncture in the modern history of proxy wars, because of Nicaragua, because of Afghanistan. But it's only got worse since then. I think it did mark a turning point.
Yeah, because I think then the war that we usually, when we think of proxy warfare in the immediate post-Cold War era, is the war in the former Yugoslavia, with the support of, in particular, Bosnian Serb proxies in Bosnia and the support that they were receiving from the government in Belgrade. First of all, the blowback against the government in Belgrade, eventually elevating to the point of a NATO airstrikes against that government, but also how that potentially complicated peace negotiations. So is that war consistent with the Cold War era? So one of the lessons is once the Cold War ends, the use of proxy war really doesn't change all that much, or were there some significant changes?
Well, what the Yugoslav case really emphasizes is one of the most dangerous side effects and consequences of proxy wars, and that's the issue of dependence. Mm-hmm. What proxy wars do, particularly if a benefactor has spent many years forging networks, forging links, and creating the actual funding and fighting mechanisms to keep that proxy group going. Once a war is over and peace negotiations are taking place, that dependence can become even more chronic in the post-conflict period, because that proxy group can often does not have the political power to stand up on its own two feet. And this often means that what starts out as a short-term intervention could actually lead to long-term embeddedness in the body politic of another state, because the proxy has become dependent upon the benefactor. So this is why, again, the allure, or the perceived allure of a short-term intervention that from the outside looks like can be done quite cleanly. Plausible deniability, it's not our troops, there won't be any flag draped coffins coming out the back of transporter planes with all the cameras there. No, none of that. However, the consequences are often more subtle, but they are often longer term. And this is often, the Yugoslav case is a key example of that, of actually how long-term dependence can be fostered from what begins as a perceivably short-term intervention.
It does seem, though, that dependence can flow both directions, that the recipient of the weaponry, the recipient of the support, can continue to drive the conflict, in part because the external actor who's providing the support can find it politically difficult to walk away from that. I'm thinking of, for example, in Kashmir, where you have, or in particular, Pakistani support for groups within Kashmir. And it's not necessarily in Pakistan's interest to escalate that conflict, but the local actors are the ones who are conducting the attacks, and it's just difficult for the Pakistani government to walk away from that.
Yeah, that's a good example. Another really good example is the case of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. It spent most of the 1980s being propped up by Syria, propped up by Iran. And as Hezbollah's power grew, as it became a state within a state in Lebanon, it became almost semi-autonomous, and its power, its political power grew, its paramilitary power grew. And Hezbollah is really an interesting example of how and when a proxy can almost outgrow its relationship with its original benefactors, and almost to a point at which the Iranians, the Syrians, were still actually wanting Hezbollah to do things, and Hezbollah was able to sort of turn around and say, no, no, right, this is our agenda now. We can start calling the shots. And that's, again, proxy wars are fluid. Mm. The dynamic, the relationship can change. What the type of relationship or the level of dependency at the beginning of an intervention is absolutely not guaranteed to be the same by the end. So again, really, buyer beware with these things, because they can be dangerous. The levels of blowback are very high. The dependency shifts. The levels of escalation can change as well. So it really is quite a volatile type of conflict to get yourself involved in.
I know in contemporary debates, contemporary discourses, this is really about this argument on peace proposals to get foreign fighters out of the conflict. First of all, how difficult is it to get foreign fighters out of the conflict once they're in? And secondly, Will this continue to be really a popular policy, as it certainly seems to have been over the course of the last few decades?
The fight against ISIS, Daesh, in Syria and Iraq crystallizes this problem, because on one level, the global coalition, the American-led coalition, has had a dual approach. On one half, the coalition tentatively, kinetically engaged with ISIS through airstrikes. But the other strand, the war against ISIS, has in large part been an indirect one, which has relied incredibly on a proxy war strategy of arming and funding an absolute alphabet soup of different militia organizations, especially in Syria. You might circumvent the risk, you might circumvent the political problem of having large numbers of Western troops doing regime-changing wars in Middle Eastern countries. Proxy wars are there to fill that gap, to fill that strategic hole where they think, well, we don't want to cede interest. But the problem is, again and again, escalation, elongation of conflict is something that I've not mentioned and is important as well, because you often just provide enough arms to a warring party just about to keep a stalemate, just keep the war going. And that just costs more lives, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And this is why the conflict against ISIS in Syria is the latest chapter in the modern history of proxy wars, and the long-term blowback is yet to really be felt.
So the lesson here is that proxy wars continue to be popular, continue to be prevalent, and continue to complicate conflicts throughout the world. Thank you very much, Andrew Mumford.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Mumford is the deputy head of the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Nottingham and the author of Proxy Warfare.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.